Test. Okay, here we go. Okay. Let's get started. So as you've noticed, I am not taking up the test tonight, nor am I marking it because we are significantly behind and we need to just start moving forward and getting a little bit caught up where we need to be. So I'm just going to start continuing on with the C spine. Of course, then we'll get to the T spine, the thorax and so forth. So as we talked about last week, you know, we looked at the relationship between the articulating processes of the C spine. We looked at the shape of the C spine. We know that we had tubercles on the TVPs. We had a foramen transversarium and so forth. When we go up to the higher parts of C1 and C2, we did talk a little bit about this transverse ligament that holds the dens of C2 within that that part of the anterior part of the of C1. But we also have to think about the fact that yes. They're week 6, right? 7? 5? 4? 4 or 5, okay. Okay, great, awesome. So the other thing is we have to remember that the superior surface of C1 also articulates with the articular condyles on either side of the foramen magnum, and that this allows for all the movements that occur, yes and no, rotations and so forth. And they're all synovial joints, except for the odd couple that were the discs are and so forth. But being that you know, when we look at a joint, we have to think about ligaments and things that are holding bones in place and preventing excessive movement and so forth. So this is why it's called specialized. So the first is, the name will say to you, the craniovertebral joint. So obviously this would be the articulation of the cranium with the vertebrae. The first is called the atlanto-occipital, which represents the articulation between C1 and the occiput, right? If we remember, we have the two condyles on either side here, foramen magnum, and remember that C1 is that completely circular bone, which is the answer to that one question, right? And we had the articular processes both superiorly and inferiorly, and they were slightly different because of what they allowed for. We remember the inferior articulating surface of C1 was more round in nature, and then the superior articulating surface was more kidney-shaped in nature, and that's where they articulate here with the condyles on the occiput on either side of foramen magnum. It is a condyloid synovial, and so therefore the concave superior articular facets on the atlas, C1, articulates with the convex surfaces of the two occipital condyles. This joint permits flexion and extension. So this is the yes joint. So that's what's occurring between C1 and the occiput. We can see it here in a number of different ways. We've got in green here, we can see C1 here superiorly, C2 below, and we can see the green representing these two joints between these condyles on the inferior part of the occiput with the superior part of C1. And the arrows kind of point in the direction where we sort of see it with radiology. You can also see it there a bit as well. A lot of the ligaments and so forth have been removed, so it's easier to see. We can see that the atlanto-occipital is here. There's a membrane we're going to talk about shortly that kind of fills in the spaces, but it sort of removed it a bit here, and you can see that relationship here. There's a number of them here as well, and we have to understand that, you know, we've got, when we look at the curve of the C-spine, this is something, you know, I've talked to you a lot about the L-spine and losing lordosis in the L-spine and how significant that is to pain patterns of low back and so forth. Exactly the same thing happens in the C-spine. You can lose the lordotic curve in the C-spine, and that leads to all kinds of problems as well. So we see we have people with anterior head carriage, which has excessive lordosis. We have people who have flat spots. I think you guys have palpated the C-spine, yes? And did you notice that in some of your partners, you got down to C3, C4, C5, you couldn't find it? Yeah, because it was very anterior. So you get those sorts of things, and that comes from long-standing poor posture and that kind of stuff. So you get a shifting with them as far as that goes. The second one is the atlantoaxial joint. So of course this is between C1 and C2. So we have the dens, or the odontoid process of C2, that is held within a collar, which is formed by the anterior arch and the transverse ligament of the atlas. So we have that dens coming up into the anterior arch, and then the anterior arch of C1 sits obviously anteriorly to the dens, and then behind it is that transverse ligament that's holding the dens in place, which allows that dens to spin or pivot. So therefore, it is a pivot synovial joint, and it permits rotation. So the atlantoaxial is yes, okay. Sorry, the cranial vertebral is yes, and the atlantoaxial is no, because of that rotation. We still have zygapophyseal joints, but they are on the inferior part of C2. So the zygapophyseal joints are between them both as well, which permits rotation as well. So we can see here is C2. We have the dens here sitting in the anterior arch of C1 with a transverse ligament holding it in place. And the one thing I want you to take note of here in the drawing, you can see that there is a synovial membrane and a synovial space. So it is a pivot joint, but it is a synovial joint. So therefore, it does have a joint capsule, it does have a synovial membrane, it does have a joint space, it has synovial fluid, and so on and so forth. Now, you have to realize that, you know, we've got the potential here for a lot of friction, right? We can see it anteriorly on the odontoid process and posteriorly between the odontoid process and the transverse ligament. So we do have the synovial membrane and fluid there, which allows that pivot to occur between the two of them without much resistance or friction at all. We can see it here in the sagittal cut. Here is the odontoid process of the dens of C2. Here is the anterior arch here of C1, and we can see again the synovial space here and here. And this thickening that we see here, this is the transverse ligament here that's running from the two tubercles on the inside of C1, correct? The next is called the nuchal ligament. You guys have palpated this thing. I've talked about it a little bit. We have to remember that this is the blending of the supraspinous and intraspinous ligaments, and this ligament runs from C7 to the occiput at the EOP, right? External occipital protuberance. So from C7 to the EOP, we have this large sheet of ligamentous tissue. It resists hyperflexion of the cervical spine. And the verification for this when you're palpating is to have your patient do what? Forward flexion, correct? Okay, and that tightens this nuchal ligament. It does get taut at extreme cervical flexion, or at 15 degrees of flexion of the head and upper cervical spine. So this again is, this can get kind of nasty in a really bad whiplash. It can actually tear if it's a significant enough whiplash, and leads to all kinds of pain patterns and long-standing care because it has to have time to heal and so forth. So we can see it here. Again, this is a lovely Netter drawing. This little line straight down here would sort of represent the supraspinous ligament as it travels from the tip of spinous processus, the tip, all the way down the rest of the spine, C-spine, T-spine, L-spine. And we can see the interspinous ligaments here between the spinous processes, but we can see how it comes much farther posterior from the tips of the spinous processes and the space between, and fills in this huge space of ligamentous tissue all the way in, right? Big, large area for muscle attachments and so forth. And it keeps your noggin from rolling down onto your chest, basically. The next is the tectorial membrane. Do you remember me talking about the tectorial membrane previously? No. Yep. Yeah. So this is the continuation of the posterior longitudinal ligament superior to C2. Right? I didn't talk about it a whole lot, but remember you've got the posterior longitudinal ligament that runs through the whole spine. Once we get above C2, yeah, it runs, it's now known as the tectorial membrane. So it is the continuation of the PLL superior to C2, and it also becomes taut with flexion of the head. So what I want you to sort of get a sense of here for orientation. So in this skull, we can see we have the anterior portion here, right? I turn around, you can see this is the anterior portion, posterior here. This is the foramen magnum, one half of it. So this ligament comes up the posterior aspects of the vertebral bodies, and above C2, it comes in and attaches right up on here. So it comes through the foramen magnum to attach onto the occipital bone here where my finger is. Okay? So you can see it's been somewhat cut away here, but it does come up into this space where my finger is. So all the way up from C2 through the foramen magnum onto the occiput. What, the ligament I'm talking about? No, this ligament is to, again, prevent overflexion and support the head. We have to remember, if we look at the head in relationship to the spine, all right, and we see where the foramen magnum is, there's a significant amount of mass anterior to the foramen magnum, correct? So if we think about a head, and I put my finger in the foramen magnum, kind of representing the spine, then gravity wants to do what? That and that. So we need things in place to prevent or support, right? So I always say jokingly, your head is like a pumpkin on a stick, right? A very large mass sitting on a very, whoops, I knew I was going to do that, a very tiny column. So we need a lot of supporting structures to hold this head in place on top of this pole of connected vertebra in this area, right? So one of, that's what we had the the nuchal ligament, so back here, filling in this spot here, preventing it, and so too does this because it comes, I said, it comes up through and attaches into the occiput here, and it also becomes taut in hyperflexion. So you can see it's been somewhat cut away here because there's lots of stuff underneath it. Here's your posterior longitudinal ligament here below C2, and then it, although it's been cut, if you took these two flaps and put them together above C2, it would cover all of this. That is your tectorial membrane. Make sense, kind of? No, it is continued past C2, but above C2, we give the same tissue a different name, the tectorial membrane. Because remember, the tectorium is the head. What's that? Yes. Okay. We may not have, but tectorium kind of represents a head or superior part. Okay. We used to use the term in charting so people couldn't understand if somebody was having a bit of a mental health issue and were kind of maybe psychotic or whatever, we'd say their condition is supertentorium. So it was outside the purview of physical problems, it was more mental in nature. Again, you can see it here, the drawing we just looked at previously. Here is the anterior arch of C1. Here's the dens of C2. Here's the transverse ligament here, posterior to the dens. And we can see here is the posterior longitudinal ligament here. And again, above C2, it's the tectorial membrane. And you see it comes all the way up into below the lower part of the brain, the inferior part of the brain, onto the occipital bone here within or superior to the foramen magnum. So we've got this dens sitting in an arch. And we have to consider what we would need to do to support the movement of this area. Now we do have the ligaments we just discussed, which help. But we do have to consider all other movements that occur. Now, where did my C1, C2 go? That's kind of strange. Put it in here. Nope. Huh. I don't. Oh, So, anyways, so you've got our circle or ring of C1, C2, the dens comes up in it. We have to support that dens, and of course, as a ligament, we have to prevent this association from going into extreme ranges, right? So we have to prevent excessive movement. So now we're getting into these upper cervical ligaments that are related to this relationship between C1 and C2, and in other words, the dens and the space that it sits in C1. So the first is called the cruciform ligament. What would that name tell you? Cruciform, cross-like, right? It's cross-like. So it lies deep to the tectorial membrane. So if we come back up here, we can see that the tectorial membrane is the most superficial of the group that's in here. We can also go back here. Here we can see this cross shape kind of happening here. And we can see, as I said, that they have severed and reflected the tectorial membrane out of the way so that we can see deep to it. So the tectorial membrane is most superficial and the cruciform sits deep to it. It does have vertical and transverse portions, hence the name a cruciform, because it's cross-like in nature. The vertical portion arises at C2, attaches to the occiput, and the horizontal portions attach on the interior surfaces of the anterior ring of the atlas and reinforces the transverse ligament. So we can see here is your transverse ligament here, and then sitting on top of it, we have a vertical portion here, and we also have a horizontal portion here. This is your cruciform ligament here, sitting, sharing fibers with the transverse that we can see here. Okay? Everybody follow? Yeah. It's the dens. It's the finger. Odontoid means tooth-like. Okay? It means tooth-like. It's just another name for the dens. We can see it here in the cadaver. Here we've seen everything removed. The tectorial membrane has been removed. We can see here this transverse ligament here, and we can see how it shares somewhat. We have vertical parts and horizontal parts here that make up the cruciform. We can kind of see it here as well. Some do call it a cruciate ligament because it crosses. Now, the reason that you got cruciate ligaments in your knees is because they cross. So cruciate does represent cross, but I tend to call it the cruciform ligament. That's what I've always kind of called it. The next is the transverse ligament of the atlas. We've talked a whole lot about it. It attaches on the interior surface of the anterior ring of the atlas. It does enclose the dens, so it wraps around the posterior aspect of it. And as I said, it's lined with the synovial membrane, and that synovial membrane, of course, provides lubrication within the joint space between the transverse ligament and the dens itself, which, of course, lets the dens spin around in a smooth, slippery environment. So we can see it here. Here we've got our C1 kind of coming around like so. We can see the odontoid process coming up from below from C2, and you can see the synovial membrane here anteriorly and here posteriorly. So the anterior is between the anterior odontoid process and the posterior aspects of the anterior arch, and the posterior synovial membrane lies posterior to the odontoid process and anterior to the transverse ligament. Next is the alar ligament. Now, the alar ligament, it starts narrow and spreads out, and it looks like angel's wings, hence the term alar, which means wing. So it's a wing-like configuration with attachments from the dens to the occiput at the lateral margins of the foramen magnum. So it comes out to the lateral margins of the foramen magnum. It checks excessive rotation and lateral flexion of the head, which would otherwise be allowed by these joints. The best way I can do it is if my hands sort of represent the alar ligaments, and you can see how it, if I'm hanging on here, I can't overturn, right? And then if I flex, lateral flexion is going to be limited as well, which is what we want. You can see here are the alar ligaments coming here and here off either side, going on to the lateral margins of the foramen magnum and holding things in place, as I said, preventing excessive rotation and lateral flexion. You can see it here as well. This is in Italian, but that's okay. Here's your ligamenta alare coming off either side here on the dens onto the lateral margins of the foramen magnum. Next is the apical ligament, and this apical ligament comes right from the tip of the dens on its apex, and it goes up on into the occiput. This ligament gets tight when you try to pull the head off. You guys haven't done traction and compression yet, have you? So you're going to learn techniques where you're literally going to take your patient's head and make them taller. Feels good, doesn't it? Yeah. So this ligament gets taut when you're tractioning the head on the spine. So we can see it right here. And on the tip of the dens, coming up in onto the occiput here. Again, inside a little bit from the using the foramen magnum. You can see it here as well in the diagram, coming right off the tip. Now, those are the major ligaments. And if you look at if you look at the relationship of where C1, C2, and the occiput kind of relate, there's a lot of empty space there. Yes, we have these ligaments that are holding elements, but there's a lot of empty space that needs to be filled. And these are filled, again, by ligamentous tissues, again, further supporting the head on, on the spinal column. These are known as the atlanto-occipital membranes, and they extend from the anterior and posterior arches of C1 to the anterior and posterior margins of foramen magnum. So if we remember, we're saying that we've got this ring that's occurring, right? So we have the dens in here, and we have the humeral, the transverse ligament there. And then we have these, we're saying that sort of arising both superiorly and inferiorly below, we have these membranes that are heading up, and they kind of fill in the spaces, so to speak. So you can see here, here's your anterior atlanto-occipital membrane. So they're running from the upper parts of the arches of C1 up underneath to the underside of the occiput, thus filling it all in with this tendinous fibrous type of tissue. We can see here is the posterior. So this is the anterior with things cut away, and then this is the posterior. So this is kind of at the posterior aspect between C1 and the posterior parts of the skull. At the posterior occiput. Oh, yeah, you're not touching any of this stuff. Oh, no. You're not touching any of this stuff. Yes. Yep. Right there. It's coming right off the tip up, and then this one shows that it's right there. So we've got tectorial membrane, we've got the cruciform, we've got the alar in here, and there's the tip right there, and that's the apical ligament coming off the tip up into the foramen magnum area. All right. Okay. So here we go. We're into the muscles. I'm assuming you've palpated many of these in lab, yes? Kind of, sort of?
We haven't gone over them, but...
In lab, you mean, or here?
Well,
we haven't done them here, for sure, but...
Really talked about them.
Okay, some, yes? Okay. So, we have a lot of muscles to get through in the area here. The first is called trapezius. Everybody knows trapezius. It's sort of that... Right, from comes out to the shoulders from the head. So it is called the trapezius because it has a trapezoid shape when looking at it. And we, for this course, will only be addressing the upper fibers, not the lower fibers. That will be for next semester in Clinical Anatomy 2. The upper fibers have a lot of influence on the head and neck, whereas the middle to lower fibers have an effect on the scapula and the movements of the glenohumeral joint and so forth. So that's why we're not talking about those. So, trapezius. It arises, the upper part, from the external occipital protuberance, think of where we are, from the EOP, the medial one-third of the superior nuchal line of the occiput, the nuchal ligament, and the spinous processes of C7. And it goes to the lateral one-third of the clavicle and the acromion. So it's a relatively large muscle. It covers a lot of surface area, right? Who wants to volunteer? You have the perfect top on for this. Okay. When we talk about trapezius, right, a lot of people think of this area here, right, as being, you know, grabbing here and feeling discomfort and so forth. Even massage therapists get very stuck on this part of trapezius. But when we look at its attachments here, right, and we think about where this muscle is, we're talking about the external occipital protuberance, okay? We're talking about the medial one-third of the superior nuchal line, which is what runs off of the EOP, right, and the nuchal ligament. So if I take my hand here and I kind of pinch a little bit of the trapezius, again, we all know about this part, right? Sometimes we massage our partners or ourselves even, but we actually have to take this, and I still got my fingers on it, and that muscle goes all the way up. And everybody forgets that. Feels kind of sore good, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay? Right? So it goes... So all the way up here. So please don't forget that if you're working on this muscle for your patient, that it's not just this mass here, which is what everybody thinks about. You got to get all the way up here if you're really going to affect change on this muscle. Okay? And it's very large in this lower area here. And as I work my way superiorly, it is a very tiny, it's about the diameter of my finger, right? It's very, very small as it comes up and in. Yeah, right there. Okay. And you can show all your friends in the lab. Thank you. Okay. No, just stay here for a sec. Sorry. So now you can face them. No, this part isn't going to hurt, I promise. So we've got this narrow area here. The part that's surprising as well, again, we think about how this muscle comes out, but now we're talking the acromion and the clavicle. So this puppy goes all the way out and comes around to here. That's the other part, is that if I'm going to work with it, I want to get all the way out to here as well. This muscle comes all the way out onto the acromion, which is kind of that flat part of the shoulder, and comes around to the front of the clavicle. So if just bend forward just a bit. So see how my fingers are kind of a C shape around? See that? See? So that's what the muscle does. It comes all the way around onto the clavicle. So please, it's the one thing that you can take the time to know all these things. When you're treating patients, you've got to think about where this is and work on areas. Because, you know, everybody, as I said, they just go right here and go, oh, patients go, oh, I love it. Right? You do this. This works really well. Doesn't it? Thanks. Okay, so keep that in mind. You know, as you learn these attachments, you've got to take them into account when you're treating your patients. You know, some of these muscles go long distances, and you want to affect change in them. Have you guys done O and I yet? Okay, so think about that. So O and I means I got to work way up here and way out here before I work on here, if that's the method that I'm using, correct? So it elevates the scapula at the scapulocostal joint. Have we talked about that? Yeah. I lifted somebody's scapula in class, didn't I? Yeah. So remember I said that it's not a true joint. The scapula does sit on the thoracic cage, but it's held in place by muscles, right? And that's why I can do a scapular lift and move it around, okay? The thing you have to remember when we talk about some of these muscles, and it's going to make a lot more sense when you get into the finer muscles of the shoulder, when we are looking at this relationship of the upper arm, the humerus, and the scapula, you can see that the head of the humerus in a neutral position associates quite nicely with the scapula, correct? The thing is, the glenoid fossa, which is this part here that articulates with the humerus, it's very shallow and small. Therefore, for all the movements the shoulder does, the best way I can put it is this glenoid fossa right here needs to follow the humerus around so that their articulation or their relationship stays normal. anything that affects the scapula's ability to move, you lose range of motion here. Okay? So when we talk about how it elevates the scapula at the scapulocostal joint, it is one of the movements that it's going to work with in that relationship of the humerus and the scapula in the glenohumeral joint. No, that's something entirely different. You'll learn that next semester. It retracts the scapula at the scapulothoracic joint. What's retraction of the scapula? Right. This. Okay, so it does this. Okay. And then it upwardly rotates the scapula at the scapulothoracic costal joint. Upward rotation is this way. Okay, so it does this as well. And again, this is all serves the purpose of the ability of the shoulder to have as much range as it does in the relationship between the scapula and the humerus, okay? If I were to take some of you and use my hand and stop your scapula from moving, most of you would maybe get this much abduction and that would be it. The general rule is for every 2 degrees of abduction is 1 degree of rotation of the scapula. And anything that limits the scapular movement, the shoulder won't function properly. So that's another thing to put in your pocket and remember for clinic time. If someone's got a shoulder problem, you just don't think about the shoulder. You got to come all the way back here to the scapula and start fooling around with that to see if it's functioning properly. And you're going to find on those scapular lifts when you get to them, some of your classmates, you might not even be able to get a hand under the scapula. Where others, you can bury your entire hand under the scapula. Right? So I've had patients where I'm lucky if I can put that much of my finger under their scapula. And then sure enough, they have shoulder problems, which relates to cervical spine issues, and that's why I'm seeing them. So I've got to get that scapula loosened up to get things to function properly. I digress. So you can see that it is related to the ability of the scapula to move in accordance to the humerus within the relationship of movement. Reverse motor action, is this our first reverse motor action? Great, okay. So reverse, it extends the head and neck at the spinal joints when working bilaterally. So if the scapula and the shoulder is fixed, when they work together, they do this. Okay? And it's the head and neck. Why? Extension, well, what's the first thing? Why is it extending? Where does it sit in relationship to the spine that would result in extension? You're saying it. Posterior, right. It's posterior to the spinal column, which would be extension. But we say head and neck because it crosses the occipital C1 and the occiput. It crosses that joint. So it crosses all the cervical vertebra, extension of the neck, and it crosses C1 and occiput to go to the EOP head. Everybody fall? Right? So again, you got to start trying to do the Superman look inside and get a feel of where things are in relationship to each other. It contralaterally rotates the head and neck at the spinal joints. Huh? Do you see that? It contralaterally rotates. Come on up, Larry. I find doing this helps a lot. Okay, so we take Larry and we think of where it is. Okay, it's coming from back here to go there. So it's coming a little bit anteriorly. It's not much, it's a little bit, but the muscle's back here and it comes a little bit anterior to get here, correct? It's not much, but it's there. So therefore, when it contracts unilaterally, remember, the attachments get closer together. See how they're getting closer together? So it's a contralateral rotator. So we take Larry's head, okay, and we draw it on here. Oh, it's dried right out. It's all good. Of course, I get two green ones at the same time. Fit his figures. So we've got Larry's head here, okay? We're saying that this muscle arises from here, near the scapula, and comes this way to its attachment on the EOP and of the head itself. So if we think about the rotation that can occur within this, if this needs to get closer to that, what direction is the nose going to go?
Clockwise.
Counterclockwise. Because this, thanks, sorry, you can sit probably. I think you're okay, thank you. This is going to get closer to that. So this is where it gets a bit confusing sometimes, because you have this sense that it really has to reach up, right? So where it sits, you think it has to really reach up. From a mechanical point of view, it's reaching up and forward, but just not a huge amount. So therefore, because it's reaching up and forward, when it contracts, the nose is going the opposite way. It's a contralateral rotator. So there's your axis of rotation. There's your muscle attachment inferiorly to the superior EOP. So therefore, if during contraction the detachment points get closer together, this is going to go that way. Contraction always means, unless it's eccentric, a concentric contraction always has the two attachment points getting closer to each other. Sure. Yes. Kind of. Yeah. Okay. But just remember that the attachments get closer together. Remember, muscles are dumb. It's just how they relate to the axis and position that has the effect that it does. It contracts and it just happens because of where it is. All right. It also laterally flexes the head and neck at the spinal joints when working unilaterally. Does that make sense? Because it's out here and it's going medial. So the muscle is going from lateral to medial, so it does that as well. Yes? Okay. Its innervation, this is a very interesting muscle. It has a cranial nerve innervation and it has a spinal nerve innervation. Now, if I'm trying to test the spinal nerve, cranial nerve 11, I resist shoulder elevation. If there's something wrong with that cranial nerve, the patient will be weak in shoulder elevation, okay? So it does play a big role in it. So it has both a cranial nerve innervation, the spinal accessory nerve 11, and C3, C4, with the majority of fibers arising from C4. We have to remember we have a big muscle here, right? But we're just talking the upper. So we can see it here. You know, it's quite large. We're just talking up here. That's all we're talking about for our purposes. You can see all the way up here the EOP and the medial aspect of the superior nuchal line, the ligamentum nuchae all the way down to C7. So see, it's filling in this area here. To stretch, it would be ipsilateral rotation, contralateral lateral flexion. Correct? Think about it. It's a contralateral rotator. So because of the contralateral rotator, the muscle is getting shorter. If I stretch it, I want to make the muscle longer. So I ipsilaterally rotate to take the two attachments and make them further apart. And then I laterally flex the opposite way to make it get even longer. Okay? You can see here to strengthen it, there's a number of different ways you can do it. We'll get into it a lot more in clinical anatomy too, in terms of all the different fibers. But the most common one, which is also the most useless exercise in the gym, is shoulder elevation. I guess, though, like, do you really want to have like these, unless you're a football player or a wrestler or something like that, where you need a strong neck. What were those, that species in Star Trek, The Next Generation? They had the great big huge, they had skin that went right from their shoulders up to the top of their heads, right? Yeah. They had big traps. Trigger points. I believe, and they also suggested on Travel, this is the most common trigger point in the human body. And I'm sure you all have one. At some point, your partner or somebody shoved their thumb into your trapezius and it's just like, oh, right? Okay. So it's said to be the most common muscle for trigger points, thought to be a cause for temporal headaches. This is the backwards question mark. That's the way I always remembered it. right? So trapezius, upper trapezius causes the backwards question mark. So it comes around behind the ear and comes over into the temple. So trigger point one, which is this one here, okay? Referred pain unilaterally upward along the posterior lateral aspect of the neck to the mastoid process. Major source of tension headaches. When it is intense, the side of the head centering in the temple area and the back of the orbit and can include the angle of the jaw. So you're going to come across this. Trust me, you're going to come across this a lot. And then trigger point two, which is down here getting a little bit farther out. You get referred pain slightly posterior to the cervical reference zones for one, and it blends into a little bit behind the ear. Okay? Next are the splenius. Splenius means bad. Actually, I might give you guys a break. Do you guys want a break? Or okay, take a break. Let's take like 10 minutes or so. I'll see you guys just before 10 after. I didn't realize that time. Last time I looked, maybe. We used to go to the, yeah. We used to go to the chiropractic college, and they literally would open the door, and they had 14 specimens there, and they'd say, fill your boots. So you'd be able to reach in a cadaver and pull out a heart that's there or whatever. Yeah. Okay, let's continue. So still muscles of the cervical spine. So the next group are called splenius. The reason they're called splenius because they're said to look bandage-like, which means they're wide and thin. Okay? And, of course, capitis means head. So this is a bandage-like muscle that attaches to the head. It arises from the nuchal ligament, C3 to C6, and the spinous processes of C7 to T4. So we can see it here, right? Here's your nuchal ligament and your spinous processes. So again, nuchal ligament from C3 to C6, spinous processes of C7 to T4. Now, that may seem confusing to you, but why spinous processes of C7? And not spinous processes, and it's the nuchal ligament. Why? If you think about it, it makes sense.
Can you
read it yourself? Yeah. Okay. It says the nuchal ligament from C3 to C6 and the spinous processes of C7 to T4. Why doesn't this muscle attach to spinous processes at C3 to C6? The nuchal ligament is there, and the nuchal ligament runs from C7 to the EOP. So the muscle does arise at that midline at the spine, but it attaches to the spinous processes lower than C7 or C7 and down because there is no nuchal ligament there. It arose from C7 to the EOP. So it's following the same line. It's just that above 7, it's the nuchal ligament. Make sense? Okay. It goes to the mastoid process of the temporal bone. And you all know where that is now, I'm assuming. You probably touched it quite often in the labs. And the occipital bone, lateral one-third of the superior nuchal line. So now we did a muscle previously that's the medial one-third of the superior nuchal line, which was? What muscle did we just do? Upper trapezius. Right? Okay. Remember, bone is alive. When you have muscles that attach to it, and muscles contract, they pull on the bone, and that's where these lines come from. It's because of the general forces that are created when a muscle contracts. So you've got this superior nuchal line, medial one-third you've got upper trapezius, lateral one-third you have splenius capitis. So we can see here in the diagram, here's trapezius, medial one-third, here's splenius capitis, lateral one-third. Underneath. Trapezius is superficial. Okay? Trapezius is more superficial. This one's underneath trapezius. Okay? Now, let's think about that. This muscle goes from medial to lateral. So what's it going to do? Before I even tell you. Goes from medial up and forward to lateral. So it is a ipsilateral rotator. And working bilaterally is an extender. Right? Get the idea? You've got to visualize in your head. That's why I do all these sorts of things like this, because it gives you the sense of medial up laterally to the head. So therefore, you got to think of it coming together, right? So it functions. It extends the head and neck at the spinal joints bilaterally, right, when working together. It ipsilaterally, laterally flexes the head at the neck and the spinal joints when working together. What's ipsilateral lateral flexion? The right one contracts and the head moves to the right side, correct? Okay. And it is an ipsilateral rotator because it's running from medial to lateral when we think about the axis in the top of the head because it's reaching up and out, okay? Innervation, cervical spinal nerves, dorsal rami, middle cervical. Have I done that? I did that, right? You guys remember what dorsal rami is? Okay, so when we look at the spinal cord, so we're going to kind of look at the spinal cord here, okay? And in here are all kinds of tracks of nerves that travel up and down to the brain and away from the brain. And in neuroanatomy, you're going to learn all of them. Spinal thalamic, it's so much fun. Okay, but you're going to learn them because they travel various, very specific spots on the spinal column. The thing is, though, there are nerves that run into or out of the spinal column. So it kind of looks like this. And I'm going to kind of do that. Would that be anatomically correct? Okay. You don't need to care what those are, just being specific. So, this means they're sensory. So, the nerves leave, because around here would be the vertebral foramen, correct? Because the spinal cord runs through the vertebral foramen, and the nerve roots exit out the intervertebral foramen, which is created by the superior and the inferior notches, correct? Okay, so this nerve, as it runs out, maybe it's going all the way down here, your head, right? Maybe it's going all the way out there, okay? The thing is, there are muscle structures associated with the spine, correct? Right? So, you know, we've got a spinous process here. We're going to have musculature here on either side and so forth. Immediately when the spinal nerves exit the intervertebral foramen, there is a dorsal branch that innervates posterior muscles, and there's a ventral branch that becomes a couple of different things, but I just want you to understand for now that right out, as soon as that nerve leaves the spine, you have a branch that heads back and a branch that heads forward. So when I say that this is innervated by the cervical spinal nerve's dorsal rami, that's telling you that this is a branch of nerve that travels posteriorly, correct, to innervate the muscles that lie very closely and intimately at the spinal column. Okay, everybody follow me? Okay. Muscle test is 157. I'm not going to worry about it. You guys are doing your muscle test. Did you muscle test this in lab? Not yet? Okay, but you will. Okay. To stretch it, so because it is an ipsilateral rotator, and an ipsilateral lateral flexion, then looking or sniffing your armpit is the stretch of this muscle. So you would take and contralaterally rotate and contralaterally laterally flex, and that will work on spinous capitis. Okay? You can do it, the patient can do it themselves, or the therapist can do it passively. Have you talked much about that in lab where there's active and passive stretching? So therapist can provide the stretch, or the patient can also learn to do it when their appointment's finished and they're at home, right? Strengthening, any kind of resistance like this. I show this because we're going to talk a little bit about this in the latter part of this course once anatomy is done, is how a therapist can actually be resistance to strengthen muscle. And it doesn't have to necessarily be weights or surgical tubing or anything like that. We can, it's not as consistent, but we can apply the resistance to strengthen, okay? Trigger point. Goes right to the top of the head. Anybody ever get headaches up here? Like just straight at the top. So this can be spinous capitis. So what I want you to think about with this muscle that'll help you with palpations, you're going from the superior nuchal line to the mastoid process. You should be able to palpate that, yes? Mastoid process to the superior nuchal line. Right? So how would you landmark this? Where would you start? EOP, good. Travel along the superior nuchal line to the along the superior nuchal line, yep, to the mastoid process, right? Okay. Another reason why you need to know your anatomy, which helps with your palpations, right? So you need to know where you're at, and that comes from knowing this material. It just helps you find it. One thing to always remember with palpation, whether someone is 400 pounds or 86 pounds, you all have all the structures that we talk about. Even if you're going through adipose tissue, once you confirm by having a muscle contraction, know you're there. You'll know you're there. But it takes practice. The next is splenius cervicis. So you can see here we had splenius bandage-like capitis to the head. Splenius cervicis tells you what? It's just in the neck. Okay, it doesn't go to the head. The name gives you the hint. It arises from the spinous processes of T3 to T6. So where is this in relationship to capitis? It's inferior to it, right? Capitis started higher up because it's going to the head. Cervicis lies below capitis, T3 to T6. And it goes to the transverse processes of C1 to C3 on those damped posterior tubercles. So you can see it here. It literally goes up and attaches on those posterior tubercles. So here's splenius capitis here, more superior. Again, superior nuchal line laterally and the mastoid process. And then we can see here cervicis does not cross to the head. So it attaches to those posterior tubercles of the C-spine, right? C1 to C3. It functions when it's working bilaterally to extend the neck at the spinal joints, not the head. Why? Right, it doesn't cross the joint between C1 and the occiput. Okay? So, it also laterally flexes the neck at the spinal joints. So, it's going to be ipsilateral lateral flexion because, again, it's starting medially and reaching out laterally. And then it also ipsilaterally rotates the neck, not the head, at the spinal joints. Again, reaching up and forward. It's reaching like this, so it's going to pull them to the same side. Okay? Innervation, cervical spinal nerves, dorsal rami of the lower cervical levels. So we can see them here. Again, here is splenius capitis that we can see here in this drawing, and you can see cervicis, how it attaches right here under these posterior tubercles. And you can see it here as well. Not those pictures are in your book. That picture is actually in your textbook. Trigger point. Whoops. The upper part of cervicis, you get diffuse pain through the inside of the head, focusing severely behind the eye on the same side and sometimes to the scalp over the occiput. This muscle, the patient will tell you, it feels like their eye is going to blow right out of the socket. That's how the pain feels. And then the lower end, at the angle down here, at the angle of the neck, at the lower part, you get pain upward to the base of the neck. Have you guys palpated these two structures or no? Okay, so did you struggle with trying to get through all the tissue to get to find one versus the other? Okay, so now you know it's about attachments, right? You know where the transverse processes are of C1, 2, and 3. Well, you think you do, because most times when I check students for the transverse process of C1, they usually kind of miss it. It's a little bit more in than you think. The TVP of C1 lies right at the angle of the mandible or behind it. So if you're not, this is why I'm sure you were told in lab to palpate it, you sometimes have the patient contralaterally rotate, which takes the angle of the mandible out of the way, and then you can feel C1. Of spinous processes?
Of the
transverse. Yes and no. I mean, once you get below C2, they're all somewhat prominent. There's a little more musculature here to get through. No, but you get more muscle. There's a lot happening in here. Does anybody here deer hunt or anything like that? Like, have you ever seen the neck of an animal that's been dressed? Like, there's a lot of muscle in there, right? Big, thick muscle to take up that whole area. Now is my favorite area, the suboccipital muscles. Have you done these in labs?
Yes.
Okay. I love these guys. I used to work on these all the time. If you were to see them in a cadaver, they're the most silliest, smallest muscles you've ever seen in your life, and they wreak havoc on people because their trigger points are awful if you've got them. Okay? They're quite significant. Sometimes, yeah. So, the suboccipital region is defined as the upper part of the neck, and it is a triangular area located between the occipital bone and the superior end of the vertebral column between the posterior aspects of C1 and C2. What can you not palpate on C1? Right. So what you need to do the next time in your lab is find C1 and then find the spinous process of C2. That's your triangle. There's your triangle. See the triangle? So there's your TVP of 2. You have 1 just a little bit above. There is no spinous process in 1, and you can see spinous process here in 2. So they fill in a very small area here on each side. Okay? No, well, it's soft. It's soft in that area. Yeah. Now, this muscle lies deep, 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 deep to trapezius and splenius capitis. So it lies even deeper than those. So you've got to get through those to get to these. Okay? I'm sure you've done posting, right?
Yeah.
Yes. So, within, you might not like it, trust me. I'm not gentle with posting. What's that? What, gentle? Yeah. Depends on how bad it is. No, trust me, it depends on how bad someone is. If I go in there and they've got significant, terrible trigger points, of course, I'm going to go slower. But so, within these suboccipitals, there are 4 muscles. Now, these are considered to be mainly postural muscles. When we say to be postural muscles, it means that they're working all the time. Okay? So, if you have bad posture, guess what? They're not going to like you very much. They're going to be a problem. Secretaries, IT people, right? People who are sitting looking down at books. This is the folks that get really bothered by these. They are all innervated by the same nerve, the dorsal ramus of C1, which is strictly a motor nerve. So whichever one we talk about, they're all still innervated by the same level, same nerve. So let's do rectus capitis posterior major. Capitis, yeah, rectus, capitis, posterior, major, okay? It's a small triangular muscle, as I said, mainly a postural. It arises from the spinous process of C2, and it goes to the lateral part of the inferior nuchal line and the occipital bone. So we can see it right here. Here is rectus capitis posterior major, right here. Spinous process of 2 going out onto that occiput, all right? So it goes out a little bit lateral onto the occipital bone. It does extend the head and neck at the atlanto occipital joints when working bilaterally. It does help laterally flex the head at the atlanto occipital joint when working unilaterally, and it does help to rotate the head at the ipsilateral side. It does these actions, but they aren't the prime ones. Its prime is that it's a postural muscle kind of keeping your head up and in an appropriate position. And as I said, the dorsal ramus is C1. Okay, so we'll get to the muscle doesn't die in a moment. So again, this one right here. Now we're going to go to, I got the trigger points early. So where are stretches? So when, who wants to come up? I need somebody. Okay. Yeah. So if I want to stretch posterior cervical muscles, I'm just going to get Tanya just to bring her chin to her chest. Okay. And that's going to work down. But if I want to isolate the suboccipitals, I'm going to ask her to tuck her chin in deep, like bring it in, and then flex. And that will work suboccipitals. So you got to get that chin in. It's a very small movement, and you'll notice a distinct difference between doing this and between doing that. Thanks. It's probably because it's so tight this way.
I just had a question that with MMT, can we isolate like specific?
Yeah, so I'm going to show you. You can't do all of them, but you can do major and the other two. Because I used to spend a lot of time working in these for sure. So that's the stretch. Your rotation will help as well. The next is rectus capitis posterior minor. Now, major is lateral to minor. Minor is more at the midline.
I'm very interested.
Yeah.
Are you stretching any?
You're tractioning. You're just pulling on the spine. You are lengthening most of the muscles in the cervical spine. So this arises from the posterior tubercle of the posterior arch of C1. Can you palpate that?
No.
And goes to the medial half of the inferior nuchal line. So we can see here is rectus capitis posterior major, slightly lateral, larger muscle because it's arising from the spinous process of C2. And then minor is arising from the posterior tubercle of 1, and it lies medial on the same line to rectus capitis posterior major. Okay? Now, these you can't directly palpate because they're on the inferior nuchal line, but you can get in the area and affect change on them. The next is something called superior oblique of the head, or obliquus capitis superior. So it tells you that its angle is oblique in nature, and it goes to the head. So this arises from the transverse process of C1, to the occipital bone between the superior and inferior nuchal lines. So now we have, we've got spinous process of the C2, to the inferior nuchal line for major, posterior tubercle to the inferior nuchal line for minor, and then we're going to come all the way out here to the transverse process of C2, and it's going in the space between the superior and inferior nuchal lines, very lateral, kind of just behind the mastoid process. So arising from that transverse process of C1 coming up into that area between the two lines of the occiput, okay? Its function, it protracts the head at the atlanto-occipital joint because it's coming from back here, right, on the TVP and going up here to the space between the two lines, so it's actually traveling anteriorly. So when it contracts, it pulls the head back towards the spine. The transverse process is one. Laterally flexes the head at the atlanto-occipital joint, extends the head at the atlanto-occipital joint, and contralaterally rotates the head at the atlanto-occipital joint. Contralateral rotation. Does that make sense?
So it's going
from the lateral. Correct. It's going from the transverse process medially towards the head in that area, so therefore it's a contralateral rotator because it's posterior to the axis for rotation, right? Because it's back here. Okay, and then the last one, although it's called obliquus capitis inferior, it does not attach to the head. Okay, it does not attach to the head. Yeah. So, spinous process of C2 to the transverse process of C1. Spinous process of 2 to the transverse process of 1. It is. It's a very, very small muscle.
Is it smaller than the rectus?
Yes. So you can see it
minor?
Here. So, no, it's somewhat. So So here's your rectus capitis minor, posterior tubercle to inferior nuchal line. Rectus capitis posterior major, spinous process of 2 to the same spot, the inferior nuchal line. Obliquus capitis superior, TVP of 1 to the space between lateral aspect, between the superior and inferior nuchal lines. And then obliquus capitis inferior, spinous process of 2 to the transverse process of 1. So now you know why it's so important to make sure that you know how to palpate the TVP for C1. A lot of stuff going on here that you need to get at, right? Now, what I want you to take a look at here, do you see a triangle here? That's kind of important. So this is a better picture than what I drew. This is just showing you here is the ventral branches and the dorsal branches in behind. You can see the nerves exiting or entering the spinal column, or the spine itself, the spinal cord, and you can see how the branches go off when I talk about dorsal rami or ventral rami. They just branch off the nerves, okay? Now, what's unique about these muscles and that triangle, they form something called the suboccipital triangle. It is a deep triangular area between the rectus capitis posterior major and the superior and the inferior obliquus capitis muscles. So we can see it right here. So here's obliquus capitis superior, here is rectus capitis posterior, and here is obliquus capitis inferior, and you can see that there's a triangle here. A nerve, lymph, an artery, and a vein all travel through this triangle. So what can happen to that triangle if those muscles get tight? Right, it'll get small and possibly impinge. So very tight suboccipital muscles and that relationship to that nerve can be the cause of headaches, blurry vision, tinnitus, and vertigo. So sometimes someone's got a bit of vertigo or the ringing in the ears. It can be these muscles being tight and occluding that triangle and having an effect on those structures that run through it. Back or forward? This you mean? Yeah, this is the master would be a trigger point causing it. This would be occlusion or compression on a nerve. Right. So this is those tight muscles will occlude or make that triangle smaller, what's more common is vertigo or dizziness, right? And you may find that you'll get into work in these areas, and the patient will express some dizziness when your thumb's getting in there working. Boundaries then, superior medially is the rectus capitis major, superior laterally is superior oblique, and inferior laterally is inferior oblique. Its floor is that posterior atlanto-occipital membrane and the arch of C1, and the roof is semispinalis capitis. We haven't got to that muscle yet. And it contains the vertebral artery and the suboccipital nerve, hence the reason why you get neurological symptomology if they get compressed, okay? We're going to find there's triangles all over the place in the human body. We need spaces for blood vessel and nerves to pass to get all the way around the body. So you'll see there's a number of them here. You see there's all these spaces, and you can see how much nerve innervation there is in the back of the head. And if you relate this to tight muscles, you can see where you're going to run into some problems. Not only just headaches and tight muscles, but possibly some neurological symptomology, such as I say, vertigo, tinnitus, those sorts of things. So all of them refer inside the skull, but you can't localize them. They're not right down to a local part. Yes. Yes. Yep, and it calmed everything down.
I think so, yeah.
And somebody should have gotten in and tried those muscles, see if there were a problem. So this headache is, or this pain from the trigger point here, it's you can't localize it. Sometimes it's called endurative headache, so this deep, unrelenting headache type of thing, which might be what your mother had. Pain extends forward unilaterally to the occiput, to the eye, and the forehead with lack of definable limits. Does that explain her headache? kind of to a degree. Yeah. Okay. So we've done posterior for now. Now we have to go anterior. Yeah, I'll make use of 5 minutes. Okay, so let's go in the anterior neck, and let's go for the superficials first. So the first, the most superficial, is a muscle called platysma. Now, you've already talked about that in lab?
Yeah.
Okay. So it attaches from the subcutaneous fascia of the superior chest within the pectoral and deltoid fascia, and it goes to the inferior border of the mandible, skin, and subcutaneous tissues of the lower face. So it travels up like this, okay? It draws up the skin of the superior chest and neck, which creates ridges of skin in the neck, right? Pulling in, depresses and draws the lower lip, right? Pulling down, and then depresses the mandible at the temporomandibular joints. It will provide some help in opening, okay? Innervation, facial nerve. Weird, eh? All the way back. We haven't talked about one of these in a long time, so... This is innervated by a cranial nerve, facial nerve, cranial nerve 7. There really is no muscle test for it. To stretch it, basically any other anterior muscles, this will kind of get used within the same thing. So we can see it here, and it's the only muscle that crosses anterior to the clavicle. The only one. Yep. No other muscle crosses anterior. So you can see it here in this drawing, how much it sort of spreads out. And that is the cadaver, and they're pulling on it, so you can see it. They've cut it away, and you're looking at it. Yes, our fat looks like chicken fat.
Is it like fused to the
muscle?
Or like
no, it just lays over top. Yeah, it's all within the fascia. This is very much like the facial muscles, except that the mandible, it's all embedded within the fascia of this upper pectoral region and deltoids. Okay, the biggie. You probably heard this term 100 times in clinic. Everybody talks about SCM. Okay? So its name tells you everything about it. The sternum. There's more than one. There's three. Sternum, clavicle, mastoid. Yeah. And there's your two combining forms, stern and cleed. So it's a word of three roots. So its attachments. It arises from the mastoid process of the temporal bone and the lateral one half of the superior nuchal line. Again, like I talked about with upper trapezius, everybody forgets about that part. They always go to the mastoid process. You got to remember it comes back here too. Okay, if you can do O and I work, you got to come back here.
If it's a dual muscle, like the lateral half, you mean like, so technically, I've got to
go
the whole
nuchal
line between.
No, one half on each side, like this.
Oh, so like a quarter.
Yes, yes.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, coming from the mastoid process kind of back to about here. Okay? It has two heads. A sternal head and a clavicular head, which makes sense because of its name. The sternal head attaches to the anterior surface of the manubrium, which is the very large flap bone on the upper aspect of the sternum. And then the clavicular head attaches on the superior surface of the medial third of the clavicle. All right? It flexes the lower neck at the spinal joints when working bilaterally. It extends the upper neck and head at the spinal joints. Flexes the lower neck of the spinal joints and extends back because you have to think of where the mastoid process is. So when we talk about lower, it's anterior here, so it flexes the lower. But because the muscle comes back and crosses here, when we think about that yes movement, right, it's crossing behind it, isn't it? So therefore, it's pulling the mastoid process towards the clavicle. So it's pulling that way. So it extends upper. It is an ipsilateral flexor when working unilaterally and a contralateral rotator. Ipsilateral lateral flexor, contralateral rotator. Ipsilateral, so when the right one contracts, you move to the right. And when you talk about rotation, when the right one contracts, when the mastoid process gets closer to the clavicle, you're contralaterally rotating. Okay? This also has cranial nerve innervation, cranial nerve 11, spinal accessory nerve. So you can see that the sternal head is more superficial and the clavicular head is more deep. I need a volunteer. I'm going to show you something. Come on, somebody, be brave. Now, do you have any problems with her? Are they tight?
Probably.
Okay, so under normal circumstances, this muscle is quite mobile. Okay, so a technique I like to use is I use a hook. So I'll take my index finger and I'll bring it to the anterior part of SCM. And then I'll use my thumb and come around behind it.
Would that be, you're on my lump
meeting, or would that be like,
oh, yeah, you're on my lump.
There's a lump there. That's muscle.
Yeah. No, I have a lump there.
Do you?
Yeah.
I go a little bit higher. Is that better?
Yeah, that's better.
Okay. So a couple of ways you can do with this. So I'm deep, so I'm at the clavicular head. And if you watch, as I roll out, I'll pop onto the sternal head. There.
Yep.
See it go? So there's the clavicular head, and watch, boop, I'm on to the lateral head, okay? So in here, I have no idea.
I think it's just squeezing at this point.
Yeah, it's the other thing you can do with it is you can twist, which is really feels good actually, doesn't it?
It does actually.
Yeah, it feels pretty good, or you can go the other way.
That one, not so much.
Yeah. All right, I can't do it with this hand anymore. My thumb's no good. But right, but again, you got to think about those attachments. It comes all the way up to here. So you got to see if you can get it. Bring your head a little bit, turn this way and up. See how tight that is up there?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And this muscle can get a lot of trigger points in it as well. And you can get all the way down into the bottom part here. Okay. The one thing you all have to remember, because you're all looking at me going, Michelle didn't say you could do that. Should massage be uncomfortable?
No.
Wrong. Yeah. Okay. Here's what we used to tell patients when I was in physio. Hurt versus harm. Is it hurting or is it harming? If it's harming, that is not where you want to be. If someone has a chronic problem that they come to you with, pain for 10 or 15 years, that's debilitating to them, what do you think it's going to feel like when you go into it? Even if you go into it lightly, is it going to hurt? Yes. Okay? So it's about, again, we talk about consent, right? It's about the understanding with the patient that, I remember Jim in particular, I had this guy, he had back problems for like 30 years. I said, Jim, I think I can fix it, but it's going to hurt because you've had this for so long and it's so restricted. Going to take a bit of time and it's going to hurt. You have to remember that. Hurt versus harm. Just before you go, the stretch then would be ipsilateral rotation, contralateral lateral flexion. We call it stargazing. Right? Okay, trigger points. I call it the headlights. Okay, so know these because they do, like, you know how I differentiated between the clavicular head and the sternal head? You're going to have patients where you get in there, you're going to be into the sternal head and have no trigger points, but get into the clavicular head and holy moly, right? They're complaining they got trigger points there. One of the biggest causes of trigger points in this muscle doesn't occur anymore. For us old people in the room, people with the telephone. Right, they're secretaries and they're like this all day. Oh, their SCMs used to be just trashed. Right? Okay, see you guys next week.